for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Got a good show, plenty of news to talk about here in the first hour, and then in the second hour we'll be talking with Doug Bandow from antiwar.com. He's written a very interesting article analyzing Rudy Giuliani's new piece in Foreign Affairs. Just despicable. Try not to talk about Giuliani for the first hour. Save up my ammo. All right, so this is Anti-War Radio. Every day here, every weekday from 11 to 1 Texas time, I sit up here and talk about how much I hate the government, which is a lot because all they do is steal and murder people and tell lies about it, and so that's not okay. So my object here is to tell you how much I hate them and hope that you'll agree with me and that you will hate them too, because ultimately that's the only way we're going to get liberty around here, is if we all hate the government. If we no longer grant them the presumption of legitimacy, when we no longer give them the benefit of the doubt, when we no longer think of them as somehow impartial and interested in everyone instead of themselves. When you deny them the presumption of legitimacy of their actions, it will become, well, impossible for them to continue on doing what they're doing. So, that's my job, is to tell you they're not legitimate. And you know, the easiest thing to do is just point to American foreign policy. How could it be that a limited constitutional republic has army troops in more than 130 countries. Between 750 and 1,000 bases, depending on how classified you get. But go with the low number. Forget all the secret bases. 750 bases that they admit about, that they admit in their basing report. And don't tell me, oh, well, we're invited guests everywhere. Yeah, America's an empire, okay? Wrap your tiny little brains around that. You don't have troops in 130-something countries on 750-something bases and tell me that they're anything but imperial occupying forces. And no, it is not outright colonialism like, you know, the British in India back in the day. It's a bit more sophisticated than that. Instead, they hand over briefcases full of your tax dollars to bribe the local politicians, to rig elections, to do coup d'etats and engineer wars, to make sure that the local, whoever the local government is friendly enough. So no, there are not redcoat, you know, American soldiers occupying the streets in all those countries. They stay on their bases and they get the locals to oppress the people. That's what it's about. Empire. Stealing. You know, like when you were a little kid and you learned that stealing was wrong? Well, this is just like that. Only it's an American empire. And just think about how insulting this has got to be to the rest of the people in the world. You know what I mean? The new world comes from, you know, out there in the middle of the oceans. Basically what probably to them amounts to a big island out there in the middle of the ocean, North America. And we're the world empire. We're going to rule all of Europe and Asia and Africa. This country, this confederation, that's only 200 and something years old. Going to dominate the whole world just because we're the last guy left standing after World War II. Seems to me like the average guy on Earth has got to be pretty sick of this by now. But anyway, I think it's funny, actually, in a sort of not very funny way, when people deny that America has an empire. What? No, all the wars we fight are defensive wars. All these fights that we're in, everybody else picked them but us. Those 700 and something, between 700 and something and 1,000 something bases around the world with American troops in other people's countries? Well, they're just invited guests. They're to help the people. They're to protect them. You know, I heard that when a Marine raped a little girl in Japan, that those ungrateful Japanese had the nerve to protest and complain that their children were being raped by the occupying American army. Can you imagine the nerve of those nips? So ungrateful that we're there protecting them. I mean, how many times have you heard that? I've heard that. I hear people say that. Man, them Japanese need to understand we're over there protecting them. Is that what that is? Because I could have swore it was that Truman nuked them and America conquered that country. And you know, I'm going to have to quit being so lazy and write a letter to the editor of the Austin Chronicle. There's this jerk who keeps writing letters week after week attempting to justify the nuking of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Well, don't you know, 1,000,000,000 Americans and 1,000,000,000 Japanese would have died if they'd done the land invasion route. And of course, never questioning the premise of the unconditional surrender. Not acknowledging the fact that Truman dropped the condition of unconditional surrender because even Truman could not bring himself to use a third nuclear bomb on another city full of civilians. At least that's what he said. Three would be just too many. No mention of that. So somebody's got to put that guy straight. I guess it'll be me because nobody else is doing it. And it's week after week after week in the Austin Chronicle with no response from the editors, with no response from any other letter writers that I've seen. Oh yeah, gotta nuke those Japanese. It saved lives. Right? That's like the car commercial. Come on down to our car lot and save money. That is, spend it. Yeah. Save lives. That is, kill them by the hundreds of thousands. Destroy them. You know, when I was a little kid, I saw the pictures where people's shadows were left in silhouette on the concrete in Nagasaki. Where the people had been vaporized. And the concrete behind them bleached, like peeled away the outside layer of the concrete or something, atomized, blown away. And there's the silhouette of somebody putting their arms up going, ah! In the shadow on the concrete. Oh, perfectly justified. I'm sorry, I'm off on a tangent talking about nuking people. America is an empire. Take a real deep breath. Put your emotions in check. See if you can do it. And admit, hey, America's an empire. And now go one further with me here. America's not supposed to be an empire. Huh? America declared its independence from an empire once upon a time. America was the champion of secessionist movements all over the world. If only in spirit. Well, just because we have 1,000-something military bases in 130-something countries, Scott, that doesn't mean we're an empire. No, we're just invited guests, helping the poor people who need our help. Gee, if you call it an empire, then, you know, I have to realize that it's my job to join the Rebel Alliance and defeat it. Because empires are evil. So I'm just going to sit here and pretend. No, no, no. Our guys, the Redcoats, colonialists, occupiers, imperialists. Nah, it just couldn't be. Nah, it just couldn't be. Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, gee, nothing I ever read by them says anything about building a world empire, because I don't read anything. I just listen to radio for all my news. America couldn't be an empire. Because then it would be my responsibility to try to do something about it, right? And I don't want that. That sounds like a pain. Alright, I'm taking a lazy Friday, you can tell. America. Whoops. Oh, you don't want to hear John Hagee, man. I don't want to play that. Not yet. Actually, you know what? I think I do want to play that. But I need to start it over. Hey, the phone number here is 646-6446, 512-646-6446. And, you know, you guys can call in and talk about whatever you want. See if you can trick me into saying something interesting. You know, a friend of mine, who I hadn't known in a long, long time, and I just became acquaintances with again. I was talking with him, and you may have heard me mention this in one of my interviews. Forget which one it was. Anyway, recently, I've talked about this a couple of times. This friend of mine told me that his friend, who's over in Iraq, or I guess who just got back from Iraq, said to him, listen, I admit it. You know, the truth is, we're not there to bring freedom to the Iraqi people, and that's all a bunch of bull. I admit it. The real thing is, we're there waiting for the big event when we have a full-scale war with Russia and Iran. And then something about the Russians have these new super weapons that we don't know about that not even America has. And as far as I know, there's only one source for that kind of crazy spin. And that is the ridiculous premillennialist, dispensationalist, rapturist, born-again crazies, which is hardly every Christian or every even evangelical Christian. It's a small segment of this population that does, as Bill Barnwell says, the sloppiest cut and paste job on the Bible that someone could possibly do in order to basically just twist it and rape it and throw it on the floor and tell it that it says whatever they want, and that is that it is their job as American citizens to force this government, to force Jesus to come back to earth and kill everyone except them. There are millions of people, actually, who believe this, and they're extremely well-organized, and they're a very important part of the voting bloc in the Republican Party. They view all earthly events through the lens of the end times, and they love it. This is not, oh no, the devil is coming. This is, we have to force Jesus to come back faster. And the way we do that is by killing all of Israel's enemies in the Middle East and creating a greater Israel. And when Israel is as big as it's supposed to be, like it says in the Bible again, then we'll have the final battle of good versus evil, and it'll be Russia, actually it'll be the Soviet Union and Iran against Israel. And well, the fact that the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, don't worry, that's all right. It'll be Russia and Iran then. Fine, if we gotta, you know, rewrite our ridiculous story here. And I like what Charles Goyette says. So what happens when we have a nuclear war and all these idiots are still here? And, you know, I guess the answer is then, you know, we beat their ass. Say, thanks a lot, jerk. The way I answered him on the show was, I guess we'll all just go through the tribulation together and be wiser for it. Those of us who are left. But anyway, so this bothers me, right? You got American soldiers who are just, you know, regular doofuses doing their patrol in Iraq, regular Americans, and they are being propagandized with this stuff. And now my friend who passed this story on to me, he didn't say anything about religion, anything about Revelation, end times, this, that. That's the thing that's really kind of got me here. And I don't know whether that was, you know, part of the story as his friend related to him in the first place, but I don't think so. I think my impression was that, well, you know, word of mouth is we're going to have a war with Russia and Iran to make the Bible come true. I guess that the Bible come true part's being left out. Just that this is what we know about policy. This is where we're going. This is why we're here in Iraq, is getting ready for the next war. And I'll tell you this, the next war against Iran is coming. And I don't know of anybody who can stop it. Sure ain't me. But Russia's not going to get into a war with the United States over Iran. Vladimir Putin is not going to get into a war with the United States over Iran. The only way Vladimir Putin's going to get into a war with the United States is if the United States starts it. And he seems like a pretty self-interested and intelligent guy. He might even try to work out a deal, you know, without just wiping America off the map, which Russia, of course, could in the space of an afternoon or less. But anyway, so this is a problem. This is a real problem, y'all. You know, you think about how crazy people got in the 1990s about, oh, when, you know, the secular left-wing, UN-loving, atheist, commie, pinko types are taking over everything, and their political correctness is taking over everything, and nah. And you know what? You know, there was a problem. Left-wingers with power are bad. But, killing for Jesus, mixing up the Bible with American foreign policy, literally basing who you want to have wars with on magic and religious beliefs. I don't think there's anything more dangerous than that. I mean, are there any earthly interests that could possibly contemplate the benefits of an American war with Russia? Of course not. The Cold War is over, man. We ought to be doing everything we can to be friends with them. The more money Russians make, the more power over their government they'll have. Let's do business. Let's be friends. There is no interest on Earth that would justify a war with Russia. Only from an insane, make-believe, religious perspective could it ever be a good idea. Unless, I guess, no, that's it. I mean, war with Iran, it's pretty clear the Israel lobby wants war with Iran for, you know, human reasons. Lockheed would probably not mind having a war with Iran. But with Russia? The people who exploded the biggest hydrogen bomb ever, that was like 300 and something megatons? You want to pick a fight with those guys? The guys who could kill all of Houston in one shot? Only a deluded religious belief can encourage a policy like that. And the fact that our soldiers over there, what percentage of our soldiers over there in Iraq right now, occupy Mesopotamia, consider this a holy war on their side? Consider this part of God's plan and so forth, rather than just evil decisions of corrupt politicians. And you know, the reason that the people who are still left in the war party are so serious about it is because they believe in this Islamofascism. They believe that September 11th, rather than being a last gasp Hail Mary attempt to get the United States to invade over there, where they could wage war against us, but instead was a harbinger of the new Islamofascist war to, you know, cut all our heads off and force our children to pray to Muhammad. They buy into that. That's what they think the enemy is here. And so, therefore, they're willing to support total war. Right? That's who is still says, well, the Islamofascists. Those people are the ones who believe that the goal of the terrorists is to cut off their head and force their children to convert. Like somehow the Muslim world is going to all build a bunch of giant ships and all get in them and come here and occupy North America. And convert us all. We'll all be speaking Arabic if the Democrats have their way. That kind of paranoid outlook. That's what, in the mind of Americans, still justify this foreign policy, the ones who still back it. Aside from the ones who are just trying to push prophecy. But I'm saying, you know, the rest of the idiots going along. Well, it's the same thing with them. Why do you think they're so pissed off? Because they think that Americans are over there to force them to change their religion. Force them to change their culture and their way of life. That's why they're fighting. It's plainly obvious, right? And then we're going to go and make their argument true. Or their worst fears true. We're going to, you know, it was Mikey Weinstein. That's who I mentioned it in the interview with. And Mikey Weinstein was talking about this is pervasive, especially in the Air Force. But in the military, this particular brand of premillennialist, dispensationalist, something, 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 crazy, born-again, rapturist, nutballs have a greater and greater influence inside the United States military. And this is extremely dangerous. And it's the kind of thing that would make a libertarian like myself even favor having secular leftist pinko commie types in power. You know, they might enslave the world for its own good, but they're not going to call it killing for Jesus. Which, by the way, you know, any of you people who buy into this, you know, war for Jesus stuff, have you ever even read any of what the guy was saying? Well, you got like the one quote or something about where he told his posse to buy swords or something. You know, these pro-war Christians, have you ever read the Sermon on the Mount? I haven't, but I know what it says, you know? I saw it on TV. I know it better than you, obviously. All right, yep, so there we are. That's where we're at in America, folks. The average doofus walking around in Iraq right now is being told through the grapevine that we're going to have a war with Russia and Iran. And this is the crazies the religious crazies, getting through all the way down to the local ground forces. Scares the hell out of me. Here's their false prophet, John Hagee.
Therefore, it is time for America to embrace the words of Senator Joseph Lieberman and consider a military preemptive strike against our land to prevent a nuclear holocaust in Israel and a nuclear attack.
Jesus.
That's the Circle Jerks. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott. Hey, this just in, thanks to Kurt in the comment section at the Stress Blog, Jose Padilla sues Donald Rumsfeld 59 other officials. The Christian Science Monitor, of course, is reporting Jose Padilla is suing former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and 59 other U.S. officials for psychologically abusing him while he was held as an enemy combatant from 2002 to 2006. The lawsuit was filed earlier this year, but his lawyers did not disclose it until this week. Great news. Now, the question is whether the military will just kidnap whatever judge is set to hold the hearing in this case and torture that judge and make sure that... No, okay. Are they going that far yet? Are they kidnapping and torturing judges yet? Well, we'll see how far this lawsuit goes. If they have to kidnap and torture the judge rather than answer for what they did to Jose Padilla, they will. That's a safe bet, if that's what it comes down to. Or maybe they'll just tell the judge, well, you know, you have grandkids, right, judge? Wink, wink. And the judge will say, oh, yeah, this lawsuit is dismissed. Because I guarantee you, and never mind Rumsfeld, nobody is going to be held for account for the torture that they inflicted on Jose Padilla. Because, of course, you'd have to hang the President of the United States. You would have to try and convict and sentence and hang the President of the United States for what was done to Jose Padilla. And then what are the crazy killing for Jesus folks going to do? We'd have a war. Although, you know, maybe if America broke out into open warfare against itself, we could leave the rest of the world alone for a little while. You know, this is where I'm at now. I'm looking at the silver linings for another American Civil War. Jeez, I guess we'd have to bring our troops home from overseas then, right? Maybe not. Maybe we'd have to stay over there to keep stealing to pay for the war. Although, no, that's not really right. Because in our empire, all the money goes out. The little bit that comes back is just to certain politically connected groups. But the net loss is incredible. Wow. Listen, I want to point you at this wonderful, in the direction of this wonderful article by Lou Rockwell. It's, of course, at the top of the page at lourockwell.com. It's called War Without End. And it's brief, and it's to the point, and in fact, quite insightful. So I'm just going to breeze through it here for you and hope I don't stumble too much. George Bush, famous for his outlandish claims that have no bearing on reality, has outdone himself by claiming that the problem with Vietnam was that the U.S. withdrew its troops rather than fighting harder and longer. In a speech to the veterans of foreign wars, he didn't say how long the U.S. should have stayed, but he did claim that the reason for the bloodshed in Cambodia and the prison camps in Vietnam following withdrawal was not the war itself, but the failure to continue the war without end. Presumably, then, if Bush were president for life back then, we would still be in Vietnam. The draft would still be in place, and the bloodshed would have continued for decades. My, what a vision. You might think this is madness. In fact, it's the reductio ad absurdum of a particular worldview that he and his friends have adopted. Along the same lines, a few years ago, William Bennett, the former drug czar turned hyper-gambler, said that we shouldn't have abandoned alcohol prohibition. It was working just fine. And after it was repealed, drinking went up. Had we stayed the course, he said, we would be a healthier and more moral society. Many on the left say we should not have abandoned the 55-mile-per-hour speed limit. Things were going just fine. The repeal has made our roads less safe and increased people's dedication to the car and made us more dependent on foreign oil. Maybe we shouldn't have backed away from 90% income tax rates. Now the rich get richer and less of their earnings are tossed to the wind. Maybe we can do the same about wage and price controls as during Hoover and FDR's New Deals. Why the heck did we abandon the war on low prices? The same goes for wage and price controls under Nixon in the early 70s. Why do we just walk away from the war on high prices? For that matter, let's go back to the Civil War, especially considering the numbers of Confederate flags that still fly outside rural homes south of the Mason-Dixon line. The military occupation and anti-insurgency was going well. And what do? We cut and ran and left a whole region to languish in racism and hate. It's interesting how those who believe in force as an article of faith eventually go the whole way, believing that the lessening of force is never the answer, and that all the problems in the world call for one and only one answer, even more scary threats of violence. Force, for this crowd, is the great organizing principle of society, the answer to all existing problems now, in the past, and in the future. It becomes for them the overriding social and political salve, and there are no considerations that can possibly refute this contention. We saw the extreme results of this mentality in the Soviet Union, which pursued the path of force for 72 years and blamed all existing failures not on socialism, but on the failure to impose this system without any misgivings or regrets. A dictator with ultimate power can impose such a system until the whole of society crumbles into a heap and still not be willing to face the errors of his ways. Force is an article of faith. To embrace freedom means to concede the limits of power. In the case of Vietnam, there would have been no such thing as the Khmer Rouge regime in Cambodia had the U.S. not embraced Pol Pot. In the same way, Al-Qaeda got its start during the Cold War because the U.S. saw the radical Islamists as anti-communist allies. The extremists in Afghanistan were seen as glorious freedom fighters. Their training camps, guns, and furnished caves were provided courtesy of the U.S. taxpayer. So it is in Iraq today. After the U.S. overthrew Saddam's government, the plan was to jumpstart a new central government under U.S. control. That's when the fighting started. What group would control it? There is no answer to that question even today. The U.S. has always thought the Shiites would run the show, religious law and all, but that plan hasn't worked out. On the day Bush delivered his speech about the coming dawn in Iraq, 15 Americans died in combat. Another 11 were seriously wounded from a suicide bomb. On the Iraqi side, 154 died and another 175 were wounded. The death parade marched through Baji, Baghdad, Tikrit, Iskandaria, Hawijah, Flafel, and Talifar. See, I don't know how to pronounce the names of every town in Iraq. The mayor of Al-Karba was assassinated. That was in one day. Now to the critical question that vexes all political and social science. Why? I don't mean the proximate cause, Lou Rockwell writes. I mean the ultimate cause. If you are Bush, the answer comes as a matter of faith. These unruly people need more force. When that doesn't work, the answer is additional force. When that doesn't work, we need more force still, and so on. War without end. There is no refuting these claims, since the matter of cause and effect requires a slightly complicated set of deductions. It is the same with all matters of government control. It was prohibition of the alcohol trade, not alcohol itself, that generated violence. It was price controls, not the market pressure for high and low prices that caused economic problems. It was the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit that made criminals out of 100% of drivers, not the normal propensity to want to get where you were going at a reasonable speed. And so it is with Iraq. The desire to get rid of the foreign military occupier is a universal feature of political history. To recognize the failure of force is to admit the state cannot accomplish all that it claims it can accomplish. It is to admit the big lie. Doing so requires humility, a willingness to own up to the mistake, a desire to face reality and to think about the long term. These are traits that the state and its managers do not possess in large supply. Witness George Bush. No, Iraq will not blossom like a rose garden the day after U.S. troops leave. There will be bloodshed, and how much we cannot know. But the critical thing is that these people will be governing themselves, and the critical thing that prevents progress today, the presence of the foreign occupier, will be gone. The solution is imperfect, to be sure, but it is better than the opposite of turning the entire world into a prison camp run by the U.S. government. which is, of course, the reductio ad absurdum, if you follow George Bush's logic to its end. And, wow, I sure like reading what Lou Rockwell writes. It's never the same old hat, you know, it's good stuff. That's LouRockwell.com there. War Without End. I love that. Yeah, they shouldn't have gotten rid of Prohibition. Look how many people drink nowadays. I mean, talk about disconnected from reality. Talk about having a religious belief that conquers all reason. He's right. It is an article of faith. And you know, you can always tell someone who only understands one thing, force, because they're the kind of people who go around saying that these or those people only understand one thing, force. I mean, whenever I hear people make that accusation, particularly against foreigners and so forth, it is just so obvious that it is merely a projection of the goofball doing the accusing. But anyway, yeah, there you go. If you believe in force, then it's okay to make criminals out of 100% of people who use the roadways by giving them unreasonably low speed limits that they're all going to break just to keep up with traffic. I remember when I was like I must have been 5 or 6. And a friend of mine, in the back seat, my mom driving, and my friend's mom in the front seat, and we were in the back seat, and we were looking up and saw the speedometer and saw that my mom was going 65 on Mopac. And I remember saying, the speed limit's 55. You're breaking the law. And it was the first time I ever caught one of my parents breaking a law. One of those things that we're all supposed to obey no matter what. And my mom said, yeah, well, I'm keeping up with the flow of traffic. I'm not going to be the one slowing everybody else down and making them go around me. So that's the way it works. 100% of all drivers, criminals. Because of the stupid speed limit laws. Not because they're criminals, but because of the laws around them. I mean, in Prohibition, is there no better example? I mean, does not everyone in America understand that outlawing alcohol was a mistake? That it did not make people quit drinking, but instead just made an open market a black market? And turned the industry... took the industry away from legitimate businessmen and turned it over to people like Al Capone? Is there anyone who does not understand that? Except for William Bennett? But of course, it is an article of faith, and in fact, I think maybe even more than Christianity, or second place after Christianity at least, the religion of force is the number one religion in this country. And it's a religion that pretty much, well, all of y'all subscribe to. Sorry, but, you know, if I had to try to count, if I could remember well enough, and I had to sit and try to count all the times in my life that I've heard someone say, well, there ought to be a law. Or, well, I'm going to sue for unemployment even though it was my own damn fault I got fired. Or, you know, I'm going to use the state against you for a reason that ain't good enough. Or I sure wish that the Congress would outlaw this or that behavior, or that the cops would go and take this person and punish them, etc., etc. Ad infinitum. Everybody believes in force. It's probably a bigger religion than Christianity in this country. And the thing is about it, you know, never mind principles, you know, never mind the fact that you don't want to be tortured, right? You want to be free to make your own decisions, right? You know, never mind that. It just doesn't work. Force doesn't work. Making people do the things that they would not choose to do themselves is not efficient. It's not the way to get things done. Liberty works. Forget principles. Forget natural rights. Force doesn't work. Somebody much smarter than me once said, the only way to die from pot is if you get shot by a cop. And that's true. I guess maybe if you had like a really, really, really big stack of pot and it fell on you. You know, if it was all bricked up real tight and it was piled to the ceiling and it fell and, you know, hit you on the head, maybe suffocated you or something. I don't know. I guess it would have to be really high ceilings and a gigantic stack of humongously heavy bales. Other than that, the only way to die from pot is to get shot by a cop. So now, does anybody think that the pot problem in America, if there is one, is that people smoke it? Or the fact that it's illegal and that people get shot by cops over it? That people are sitting in cages over it? That it's a perfectly legitimate market that has been made into a black market by a bunch of goofballs like you who sit around at your kitchen table saying, well, there ought to be a law. I don't smoke pot, so anybody who does ought to get locked in a cage like an animal. Because what do I care? I'm an American. My religion is force. And if you're not like me, then I think that you ought to be locked in a cage. Simple as that. When, obviously, the only problem with pot, the only problems really generated by pot, aside from a little bit of laziness here and there among some people, is the fact that in business deals, other than, you know, the cops killing you for having some or kidnapping you and locking you away for having some, it's people doing business deals in a black market when major dollar figures are at stake, as is the case with drugs, and there is no legitimate resolution dispute, such as in a real emergency call a 911 or taking someone to civil court to enforce your contract. Instead, people enforce their own contracts. And now, as far as I know, there's extremely little violence in the black market of pot. But when you're dealing with other drugs like heroin and cocaine and so forth, hell of a lot of violence associated with these drugs. But it's because they're illegal. Period. And you should not have to be, like, really smart and have a PhD in government-hating like me to realize that. It's the fact that it's a black market is what causes all the violence. Somebody rips you off for $10,000 and you have no other recourse but war, then that's what happens. That's what drug dealers do. And so it's the fact that the market is black is what generates all the crime. It's what drives the prices up by tens of thousands of percentage points. I mean, seriously, a giant bag of really good pot should cost the same as a head of lettuce, right? There's probably less goes into growing it. It's a weed, man. The only reason the prices are so high, and, you know, it's hard to talk about weed and all other drugs because they're sort of, it's sort of separate and different. You know, you look at crack cocaine and the kind of violence that goes into controlling territory, having a monopoly on the right to sell cocaine here or there. Of course, that's what any business would like to do, right? If you outlawed hardware, the guy at the hardware store would probably work with, you know, his newly hired, you know, underground criminal security force to secure this part of town is our turf and only we sell hardware around here. That's how it would be immediately. It's the fact that hardware is legal to sell that you can rent a place right across the street and compete with that guy and drive down the price and let the neighborhood save money on their hardware. And he can't do nothing about it but cuss. But no, you outlaw wrenches and screwdrivers and paint rollers. you will have criminal syndicates of hardware dealers who basically act like little governments claiming territorial monopolies, extracting protection money, and trading in the illicit hardware and hammer and ratchet markets. Seems simple enough. I don't know. I'm sorry. I just got to talking about the drug war. And it just bothers me to no end that there are Americans, Texans, Austinites, human beings, individuals who were born free, who are locked in cages, who are sitting in cages right now over weed, over cocaine. That is criminal. I mean, I'll tell you, I've seen crack zombies before. I've met crack zombies. And I'll tell you, if you're a kid listening to this show, don't smoke crack. That stuff's bad for you. They exaggerated how bad pot was for you, I admit that. But they weren't exaggerating when they told you crack was bad. You know, but the war against crack zombies is far worse than crack. The war against pot smokers is unforgivable. If you want to smoke crack, you're over 18, you own yourself, smoke away. If I run into you, I'll recommend that you switch back to pot. But, you know, I'm not going to beat you up or kidnap you or lock you in a cage over it. Hey, did you guys know that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Peter Pace, is saying he wants to reduce the size of American forces in Iraq by half? You believe that? No, one second. Let's see if I can get an update on this Padilla lawsuit here. That's such great news about Padilla. Oh, here we go. He copied and pasted the whole damn thing. Oh, no, he didn't. There's the link right here. Okay, I'm going to try to get to this Padilla in the next top of the next hour here. Top general to urge Iraq troop cut from the LA Times. This article is at the top of the page, somewhere very close to the top of the page on antiwar.com right now. Top general to urge Iraq troop cut. General Pace, who opposed the surge, is now saying it can't last. We don't have the troops. You're breaking the army. You gotta bring them, half of them home by a year from now, by next spring or so, I guess. It's late August, so less than a year from now. And you know George Bush says, I'm a commander guy. And I think a lot of people took that out of context. Like, what is he doing? He's just trying to make the definition of his office so vague that he can just command whoever he wants? Or what was he saying? No. It was, you know, the worst of sloppy English. Even worse than mine. What he was saying was, I'm the kind of guy who listens to what the commanders say. It's not my fault that the policy in Iraq sucks so bad. It's Tommy Frank's fault. It's General Casey's fault. It's everybody. It's Abizaid's fault and Sanchez's fault and Condoleezza Rice's fault and everybody's fault but mine. I'm a commander guy. I do what they tell me to do. But, of course, that's a damned lie. The president said that right after he just fired Casey and Abizaid for opposing the surge. He had just had a meeting with the Joint Chiefs in the Pentagon, and they told him, hey, let's not do this. And then he went ahead and did it anyway. Oh, I'm a commander guy. Well, now here's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is telling Bush, hey, man, time's up. And, of course, he'll be fired almost immediately. We'll see what happens to him. And I love this, the new national intelligence estimate that the CIA put out yesterday. And I haven't had a chance to really analyze. I just read over it briefly once. But it basically sets the stage for, yeah, we're making progress. It's hard work, but we're making progress. Just, you know, for posterity's sake, those listening to this on MP3 30 years from now or whatever, this is August 24th. 2007, 4.25 years after the invasion, and they're still telling us, yeah, we're making progress, 6 more months. Like I said yesterday, this would be 6 more months forever. It's like, isn't that like they call that a Friedman unit of time or something? because Thomas Friedman kept writing in the New York Times over and over again, just another 6 months and everything will be fine. Another 6 months and everything will be fine. And we're going to keep doing this apparently forever. Peter Pace will be gone and they'll conscript your kids if they have to. See, a little bit of economics will teach you. You give them an endless supply of cannon fodder, they're going to have more wars, not less. Now, some backlash on the part of the parents might happen and lead to some reversals of policy much further down the road, but you don't give government an endless supply of soldiers and expect that things are going to get better rather than worse. See, just the basic economics will tell you that. Give a little kid 100,000 army men and see how many of them he destroys. Because he's not really concerned. There will be fires. There will be, you know, black cats going off. BB guns taken out. So this NIE comes out and says, just keep surging. Just 6 more months. Everything will be fine. Everything will be fine. John Warner, who is considered to be, you know, Mr. Respectable right-wing pro-war Republican leading Republican old man, whatever the hell kind of status in the Imperial Senate. He's saying, we got to start getting out of here, man. We should start the exit by Christmas. Start getting our troops out. But does it even matter? After John Warner has sat back and told Bush, kill whoever you want, I'll protect you in the Imperial Senate this whole time. Is it not too late now? I mean, does anybody think that the Republicans in the Senate can tell Bush what to do at this point? Since they haven't tried all this time. And then, again, I see this headline, military fears Tet-style offensive. Oh yeah, the surge is working great, we're making progress, everything's fine. But then you talk to some of the guys on the ground in Iraq, and they say, man, we're worried that everybody's going to gang up on us at once, and we're going to get, you know, we're going to have some major battles to deal with here that we're not ready for. That's kind of scary. A mini Tet, that's what they're calling it. But then again, maybe that's not the guys on the ground. Maybe that's Bush trying to prepare us for the redirection, for the betrayal of the Shiites. Coming soon. Okay, I'm going to play y'all some music, and then I'm going to come back and I'm going to read through this Christian Science Monitor article here. It's by Warren Ritchie. My guest from just the other day. And then we will be talking with Doug Bandow about Rudy Giuliani and how unfortunate it is for you and I that he understands the world in the way that he understands it. Doesn't look good. All right, this is Anti-War Radio, Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Thanks, guys, for tuning in, and we'll be right back.
Analogy! captain turned civilian. The lieutenant becomes casualty. The lieutenant becomes casualty. The enemy turned captain. The captain turns civilian. The lieutenant becomes casualty. The lieutenant becomes casualty. There are doubts in your ability. There's too many blinds in your analogy.
What the hell? One more. Chaos Radio. Quick note, tonight there is a Ron Paul meetup. I went to the first one, and then I missed every other one, so I feel like a real chump. But tonight I'm going to the Ron Paul meetup. It's at the First Unitarian Church at 4000 something Grover. Basically, it dead ends into the church, and Grover begins northbound from the church. If you know what I mean, if you just take Grover as south as you can from, like North Loop or something like that, you'll run smack dab into the place, tonight at, I forget, 7:30, something like that. You can look it up online at the, Ron Paul meetup groups and all that. So, hope to see you guys out there. And Sunday, the 26th, couple of days from now, is the gigantic Ron Paul birthday barbecue bash in Texas City, south of Houston there. So, hope to see you guys there. I went there 2 years ago. I tried to go 3 years ago, got stuck in the rain, stuck in Houston traffic, couldn't get anywhere near the place. It was over by the time I was supposed to be there, so I just turned around and came out. But 2 years ago, I went and I had a great time. I ate some great barbecue. And I got to meet Lou Rockwell and a bunch of other really great people there. And Ron Paul gave a great speech. And I saw at the end of the barbecue, a guy from the Green Party of Texas came up. A real tall black guy. Real big guy. And he says, Ron Paul, I'd love your property rights answer to environmental questions. And Ron Paul went into this whole thing about, that's right, individualism and property rights and plain old individualism style common law from Great Britain from 400 years ago be plenty fine to protect the environment. It's the federal collectivization of property and executive regulation of pollution that allows the problems that we have now to continue on. Property rights is the answer. And the guy from the Green Party said, yeah, I totally dig it. And I thought, man, Ron Paul really is something else, isn't he? So, yeah, I hope to see you guys there. That's this Sunday. It's at 1 o'clock or something in the afternoon, I believe, 12 or 1, in Texas City. The Ron Paul Barbecue Jam. You can look it up online and read all about it. Okay, now, I only have a few minutes before it's time to talk to Doug Bandow to fit this article in. I'm looking forward to talking to Doug Bandow. Don't get me wrong. It's just I've got this article I got to squeeze in here. Now, Warren Ritchie, you know him. I interviewed him earlier this week, and on Tuesday, I think, Wednesday. And I've interviewed him a couple of times before. He's a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor and has been doing a hell of a job following the Padilla case and coming on Chaos Radio Airwaves and explaining it to us, too. So this is a breaking story. Christian Science Monitor, Warren Ritchie. Padilla sues U.S. officials over confinement. Again, thanks to Kurt in the comment section on the Stress blog there. Convicted Al-Qaeda operative Jose Padilla is seeking to hold former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and 59 other U.S. officials responsible for what his lawyers say were abusive and unconstitutional tactics used against Mr. Padilla while he was held in military custody as an enemy combatant from 2002 to 2006. Lawyers working on Padilla's behalf filed a civil lawsuit earlier this year in federal court in South Carolina. It was publicly disclosed by the lawyers this week. Mr. Padilla suffered gross physical and psychological abuse at the hands of federal officers as part of a scheme of abusive interrogation intended to break down Mr. Padilla's humanity and his will to live, the 30-page complaint says. The grave violations suffered by Padilla were not isolated occurrences by rogue lower-level officials, the suit says. Besides Mr. Rumsfeld, it names Defense Secretary Robert Gates, former Attorney General John Ashcroft, former Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, and former Defense Intelligence Agency Director Lowell Jacoby, among others, who personally ordered and or approved Mr. Padilla's detention and interrogation program. Last week, Padilla was found guilty by a Miami jury of conspiring with Al-Qaeda to engage in violent jihad. Federal prosecutors said he attended a training camp in Afghanistan. He faces a potential life sentence in prison. Some analysts have pointed to Padilla's conviction as vindication of the Bush administration's alleged harsh treatment of him at the U.S. Naval Consolidated Brig in Charleston, South Carolina, prior to his transfer to the criminal justice system in early 2006. But other analysts say that regardless of the guilty verdict in Miami, significant constitutional and other legal issues surrounding Padilla's treatment by the military remain unresolved. Chief among them is whether a U.S. citizen like Padilla, who is arrested on American soil, can be stripped of most of his constitutional rights, all of them, while being held in military custody and interrogated as an enemy combatant. Padilla was held at the brig for 43 months. According to the court docket, a Justice Department lawyer is representing each of the named defendants. Andrew Ames, a Justice Department spokesman, said the government would have no comment on the pending case. The defendants have been ordered to respond to the suit by October 15th. A Defense Department spokesman also offered no specific response to the lawsuit, but repeated earlier statements that all detainees in the War on Terror are treated humanely. Yeah, right. They tortured Padilla. We know they tortured Padilla. How dare they lie like this? Came out in the court. They admitted what they did to this guy. Padilla's lawyers are asking U.S. District Judge Henry Floyd to declare Padilla's treatment in the brig unlawful and a violation of the Constitution. They're also asking the judge to award damages of $1 against each of the potential 60 defendants. $1, huh? Although Padilla's lawyers are not asking for millions of dollars in damages, the case raises landmark constitutional issues dealing with the scope of the president's power as commander-in-chief to sweep aside many of the constitutional rights of citizens whom he determines are enemy combatants. The suit is also significant because it is the only means available of subjecting Padilla's military detention to the independent scrutiny of the federal judiciary. This is the American people's last chance to know what happened behind the closed doors in Charleston, and the last chance for a court to determine if what happened is consistent with our Constitution and values, says Jonathan Freeman, one of Padilla's lawyers who also works with the National Litigation Project at Yale Law School. Unlike the Abu Ghraib scandal, which has involved the prosecution of a few low-level individuals, the Padilla lawsuit seeks to hold the chain of command accountable. In addition to cabinet-level officials, it seeks to identify and hold accountable key Briggs staff members, military and other government lawyers, medical and psychological staff members. That's right, doctors helping torture Americans under military control, Brig guards, and Padilla's interrogators. Most of the prospective defendants have not yet been identified by name in the suit. Padilla was subjected to sleep deprivation, stress positions, prolonged isolation, and sensory deprivation, among other interrogation techniques, the suit says. These procedures were calculated to and actually did disrupt profoundly his senses and personality, the complaint says. It was done to, quote, destroy Mr. Padilla's ordinary emotional and cognitive functioning and break his will in order to extract information from him and punish him. The government held Padilla for 2 years without any outside contact, including with his lawyers. When that policy changed, government officials warned Padilla not to reveal any conditions of his confinement to his lawyers. They told Padilla that his lawyers were not trustworthy and were actually working for the government, the suit says. If true, this would amount to a government effort to undermine the ability of Padilla's lawyers to learn of Padilla's actual conditions of confinement and effectively challenge them in court. Padilla was denied access to mental health care, the complaint says. Military officials, quote, deliberately, and see, that's not really true. They had the psychiatrists working on him, but they weren't helping him. I guess you wouldn't call it care. Military officials, quote, deliberately caused Mr. Padilla to undergo extreme psychiatric stress without providing any psychiatric care, the suit says. They denied this access even after Padilla's lawyers reported, quote, signs of psychiatric distress in Mr. Padilla, such as involuntary twitching and self-inflicted scratch wounds on his body. The suit also says that 2 years into his military detention, Briggs' staff grew so concerned about Padilla's psychological distress from his prolonged isolation that they asked for permission to at least allow him to eat his meals with another prisoner. The request was denied. God damn, would you get a load of that? The suit also says that 2 years into his military detention, Briggs' staff grew so concerned about Padilla's psychological distress from his prolonged isolation that they asked for permission to at least allow him to eat his meals with another prisoner, and the request was denied. One major hurdle for Padilla's civil suit is whether the government will ask Judge Floyd to dismiss it on grounds that any open court discussion of Padilla's interrogation and treatment in the brig would reveal state secrets. Yeah, you can bet on that. Legal analysts are divided on whether a judge would throw out Padilla's case should the government invoke the so-called state secrets privilege. A lawsuit filed by a German citizen mistakenly held and interrogated in a secret locations overseas by the Central Intelligence Agency was dismissed on those grounds by a federal judge in Virginia. In March, the action was upheld by the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which also has jurisdiction over cases in South Carolina. That case has been appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. That's Warren Ritchie and the Christian Science Monitor. Doing a killer job as always. Well, good luck to Jose Padilla. I don't believe that he ever even went to Afghanistan. I haven't seen the slightest bit of evidence that didn't come out of a torture room that says he did. As far as I'm concerned, he's completely innocent of anything but traveling overseas to learn about Islam and seek a life beyond the employment of Taco Bell. But if everything that they say about him is true, he's already done his time plus a million. He ought to be a free man right now. And hell, the guys that arrested him admitted they didn't want to arrest him. I didn't want to arrest him. That's the quote from Russell Fincher, the FBI agent who arrested him. I didn't want to arrest him. Wanted to use him as an informant, but he wouldn't go along. So we turned him over to the Navy to be tortured. My country, 'tis of thee, and all that, you know.
If you were president, what would be your strategy for ending the war in Iraq?
Congressman Paul, what would it be?
Just come home. We just marched in. We can just come home. We went in there illegally. We did not declare war. It's lasting way too long. We didn't declare war in Korea or Vietnam. The wars were never really ended. We lose those wars. We're losing this one. We shouldn't be there. We ought to just come home. Because it's the number one reason, it's in our national self-interest and for our national security. Think of our defenses now, how run down they are. What is the morale of our military today when they're sent over there for 12 months and then they're kept for another 3 months? They come home and less than a year's rest, they're sent back again. Congress is currently trying to change the rules so we give these men an adequate rest. This war is not going well because the foreign policy is defective.
Congressman Hunter?
Yeah, sure. I, of course, opposed the war a long time before it started. The neoconservatives promoted this war many, many years before it was started. Had nothing to do with al-Qaeda. There was no al-Qaeda in Iraq. There were no weapons of mass destruction. Just think of the weapons the Soviets had in the 60s and the 70s, and we did not have to go to nuclear war with them. There's no reason to go to war against these third world nations. At the same time, those individuals who have predicted these disastrous things to happen if we leave Iraq are the same ones who said as soon as we go in, it will just be duck soup. It'll be over in 3 months. It won't cost us anything because the oil will pay for it.
He forgot about
9/11. And at the same time... At the same time, the individuals who predicted the disaster, of course, the domino theory in Vietnam, I was called to duty. I accepted that duty in the 60s. I served 5 years in the military. When we left there, it was tough. Yes, but now we trade with Vietnam, we talk to them, the presidents come to this country, we go back and forth, we invest in that country. We can achieve much more in peace than we can ever achieve in these needless, unconstitutional, undeclared wars.
Senator McCain. What I want to get into it is with a bit from President Bush's second inaugural address, where he made the spreading of democracy the core of his foreign policy. Here's what he said.
So it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world.
Governor Huckabee, since that speech, there have been free elections in Gaza. They elected Hamas. There have been free elections in Lebanon. They empowered Hezbollah. There have been free elections in Iran. They elected President Ahmadinejad. Has President Bush's policy been a success, and would the spread of democracy be the core of your foreign policy?
Our responsibility is to spread democracy here, make sure that we have it. This is a philosophic and foreign policy problem, because what the president was saying was just a continuation of Woodrow Wilson's making the world safe for democracy. There's nothing wrong with spreading our values around the world. But it is wrong to spread it by force. We should spread it by setting example and doing a good job here. Threatening Pakistan and threatening Iran makes no sense whatsoever. We went in and I supported going after the al-Qaeda into Afghanistan, but lo and behold, the neocons took over. They forgot about Osama bin Laden and what they did. They went into nation building not only in Afghanistan, they went unjustifiably over into Iraq, and that's why we're in this mess.
Mayor Giuliani, both Governor Huckabee.
Excuse me.
During the Bush administration, there's been a growing controversy over the role of the office of the vice president. As a candidate for president, what authority would you delegate to the office of vice president? And should those authorities be more clearly defined through a constitutional amendment?
I certainly wouldn't support an amendment to change the role for the vice president. But there's no way to know exactly what goes on. But if you take perceptions from Washington, most people there behind the scenes think the vice president is more powerful than the president. Philosophically, I think this is the case. It's obvious that he represents the neoconservative viewpoint, and my objection is that that has been the rejection of the Republican Party platform and traditional conservatism, and I think this is where we have gone astray. We have drifted from our fundamental premises and the conservative values that this party used to...
Congressman Hunter, we've got an email question coming in, and I'm going to ask every one of you to come in on this for 30 seconds. It comes from Adam Waldron from Pocatello, Idaho, and it starts like this. I have made several mistakes that have been defining moments in my life because of what I learned or was forced to realize. What is a defining mistake of your life and why? Congressman Paul?
The only mistake I made and continue to make is I don't speak forcefully enough for the cause of liberty and the cause of the Constitution. I'm working on it all the time.
Governor Huckabee. We have one more round. I also want to bring all of you in on this for about 30 seconds each. And I'm going to introduce it by showing everyone something that President Bush said at the Iowa straw poll 8 years ago. It was his fundamental promise as president.
I know this. Should I be fortunate enough to become the President of the United States, that when I put my hand on the Bible, I will swear to not only uphold the laws of the land, I will swear to uphold the honor and the dignity of the office to which I have been elected, so help me God.
I would restore openness to government. I do not think in this country we should have secrecy of government. The purpose of government is to provide privacy for the people. I would never use executive privilege to deny information to the Congress. With the full realization that you protect security information, but in the very general sense, we should be very, very open. We want a transparent government, and currently I believe we could improve on that matter.
Congressman Hunter, last word. Thank you. Thank you all. It was a great debate.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone who's watching back at home. We will be back in 2 weeks, August 9th.
Well, Dying to Win is a very important book. Of course, Michael's book on imperial hubris, these are all important books. But Dying to Win is critical because Pape is the only one that has gone back and studied several hundred individuals who committed suicide terrorism to try to understand their motivation. And when I started reading his book, I was convinced he was wrong on his thesis, because his thesis was that it wasn't religious fanaticism. And, you know, we've all heard that, and I accepted that. So I said, well, I'm going to read it anyway, but I'm skeptical. But by the time I finished it, he convinced me that, you know, religion can't be ignored, and that's part of it, and their religion's different than our religion. But the number one cause was occupation by a foreign power. And he pointed out some important issues. He said the country that has the most suicide terrorism is Sri Lanka. That isn't even Muslim. That has to do with the Hindus and the Indians, you know, fighting with each other. But they commit a lot of suicide terrorism. And the most radical countries that have more radical Islamists, Iran and I think Sudan, they don't commit suicide terrorism. But they came from, you know, Saudi Arabia, that felt like we were occupying. And even there was no suicide terrorism before the Iraqi war in Iraq. You know, it's hard to believe it, but even under Saddam Hussein, there was more tolerance there. You know, Christians lived there, and half of them now have been run out of the country.
Right.
So it's the occupation. He's convinced me of that, and that we should understand that. That doesn't excuse them. I mean, they're still criminals, they're still murderers, and you know, all these things, and we have to deal with it, but we ought to understand why it occurs so maybe we can neutralize it. And besides, changing our policy shouldn't be a big deal, because it's only changing the policy to what I think is a wonderful policy of non-intervention,
right,
following the Constitution, the advice of the founders. It's very practical. Besides, we can't afford this warmongering stuff that we do anyway.
Certainly.
We're going broke.
life, cause for you, you'll get out of my way, cause I'm crazy and I'm hurt. Hurt on my shoulder. Going faster. I won't apologize for acting out of line. You see the way I am. You leave anytime you die, God. I'm crazy out of mind. Hurt on my shoulders. Going faster.
Anti-War Radio. Alright, enough stalling for time. I can't get a hold of Doug Bando. Hey, that's the way it goes sometimes, live radio. I thought this was funny. On the LouRockwell.com blog, Tex McRae. I'm so glad Tex is back blogging again. Tex wrote, New York Times campaigns against Ron Paul. How else to interpret this weaselly story that tries to downplay Ron Paul's rock star reception at Google by quoting second quarter donations as if they were the response to Ron's successful appearance? Since second quarter donations closed 2 weeks before Ron's record-setting Google visit, and we know that one Google employee handed Ron a $2,300 maximum donation check at the Google talk, what can one conclude but that the Times has deliberately figured out how to prop up the big Dems at Ron's expense? And, see, before I follow the link to the New York Times, but the blog continues, so maybe they got the, oh, I see, she's got the chart here. Cumulative viewership by day. Ron Paul at Google and so forth. But now, you go to the New York Times story here. This is from the Lou Rockwell blog again. In primary, Tex Home is a magnet. So anyway, it's talking all about Google, right? All the how all the candidates want to go to Google. And it says, the destination, Google's headquarters, is packed full of young millionaires, just the kind of audience presidential candidates want to meet while building campaign funds. Already, Google, the fast-growing search and advertising company, has been visited by five candidates, including Hillary Clinton, John McCain, Barack Obama, and Bill Richardson. When Representative Ron Paul, the iconoclastic Texas Republican, appeared, he attracted an overflow crowd of about 250 people, and 100 others watched on monitors from another room. Paul garnered $3,350 from Google employees. But Mrs. Clinton got 10 times that amount from Google employees, and Mr. Obama raised nearly twice as much as she did. Well, I have an answer for you, Tex. Tex asks the question, what can one conclude but that the Times deliberately is ignoring the dates on these numbers in order to prop up the big Dems at Ron's expense? I think that is a very likely explanation, Tex. I think you're very likely onto something there. At the New York Times, they will do anything they can. Well, other than that one reporter wrote a pretty nice thing. But other than that, you could see why the folks at the New York Times would do anything they can to play down Ron Paul's success. And, of course, he was the biggest success at Google out of all of them. On the other hand, this could simply be, Tex, the explanation could simply be that the people who write the articles at the New York Times are really stupid. And that they cannot be relied upon to do such things as check calendars and dollar figures and Federal Election Commission cutoff dates and expenditure reports and such. I think if you start with the premise that the folks at the New York Times are capable of doing good journalism, you might find yourself frustrated at their plots against the truth. Whereas if you just recognize that if they were decent reporters, they wouldn't be working for the New York Times in the first place, then things like this aren't so surprising. Although, it's funny how it just happens to be the candidate that I like and the candidate that Tex likes is the one that they're screwing in this article anyway, but we'll see about that. All right, so let's see. I got an email from Doug. He's back at the place. So what that means is I'm going to play you music again, and then I'm going to get Doug Banda on the phone, and we're going to spend, almost half an hour or so talking bad about Rudy Giuliani. That sounds okay, right? Okay, well, hang on. Here's some dang darn Motorhead for you. Everybody likes Motorhead. Especially me. You friends. Welcome back to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and our guest today is Doug Bandow. Antiwar.com/Bandow, openmarket.org, and the number 4, pundits.com, is where he writes and blogs. He's a member of the Coalition for Realistic Foreign Policy, former aide to Ronald Reagan, author of the book Foreign Follies, America's New Global Empire. Welcome back to the show, Doug.
Happy to be on.
Yeah, good to talk to you again, sir. So Benito Giuliani has penned this essay in Foreign Affairs explaining what he intends to do with his power if elected president. And you have this article up today, Rudy Giuliani, confused, ignorant, or deceitful. I'm not sure those are mutually exclusive ideas. You say in your article today that he is breathtakingly naive, shockingly irresponsible, and cynically dishonest in turn in this Foreign Affairs article. That sounded like a pretty good summary to me.
Well, it's an extraordinary piece, and what frightens me is that, you know, this is the kind of article, you know, they don't throw these things off. I mean, this is where you have the campaign staff, you have all of his foreign policy advisors. I mean, everybody sits down, they throw this thing back and forth. I mean, this is their opinion, and if this is what they have him saying, I have to believe he believes it. Indeed, I suspect he's probably worse privately, you know, and this is kind of the watered-down version of Rudy Giuliani.
Right, and for people who aren't familiar, Foreign Affairs is the journal, the bimonthly journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, created in Europe after the First World War to try to lobby the Senate to pass the League of Nations Treaty, and has worked ever since to expand American influence in other people's countries. And
Establishment journal. I mean, if you think of kind of American foreign policy, if you think of international business, you think of diplomats, you think of, you know, this sort of you know, crew. I mean, this is the group. So that he's making this pitch to them. You know, he's you know, this is the kind of the top of the American foreign policy establishment. This is what he's providing to them. Again, this tells me. I mean, this is Giuliani. This is not a put on job.
Right. And now you say. He starts out invoking 9/11, and basically using the same phraseology as used over and over on television, which is, only I understand it. The rest of these people just don't understand Islamic terrorism, but I was there that day. I know.
You know, it's a wonderful political line, and, you know, there's no doubt that, you know, even for him, I presume it was a somewhat scarring experience in kind of what he went through. But unfortunately, you know, it tells you absolutely nothing about what to do about foreign, you know, policy. It doesn't tell you anything about how to deal with terrorism. The fact you saw it firsthand, well, you know, we have soldiers who fight in wars and they see people die firsthand. That doesn't tell them necessarily what you do when you go to war, how you deal with other countries. So he's trying to, you know, essentially turn into an asset, you know, one of his greatest failings, which is, frankly, he knows nothing about foreign policy. You know, he's been a U.S. attorney, he's been a lawyer, he's been a mayor. You know, those things are legitimate, but they don't tell you how to kind of deal with the rest of the world. He's never learned that, and this article sure shows that.
Yeah, now, I noticed, now, what he said on TV over and over again is, it's the terrorists' war on us. It's not the war on terrorism, it's their war on us. Only, in this article for Foreign Affairs, he doesn't say us. He says, it's the terrorists' war on the international system. It's the terrorists' war on the global order. And I wonder if you think that that's really his policy, or is he just saying that to suck up to the CFR crowd?
Well, I assume that, you know, part of it is, you know, simply you talk differently to the council folks than you talk to the American electorate. You know, it's much better soundbite on TV to say they made war on us. Frankly, if you're going before the Council on Foreign Relations, that sounds just a little bit too populist. You want to kind of sound a bit more sophisticated. You want to make it sound, frankly, you want to make it sound more like a foreign policy and not just, I don't know, personal revenge or something. So I'm not sure that there's a difference there in terms of what he means. It strikes me he's talking to different audiences. But, of course, you know, it's the same problem, which is, you know, why are they conducting this war? I mean, he acts as if this kind of came out of the blue, you know, that there was nothing to suggest it, you know, just this evil war they've been fighting for decades, and we just haven't fought back, you know. Well, I mean, it's a nutty analysis.
Well, but couldn't it be said, and we'll get to the terrorist thing and the motivations and all that in a second, but couldn't it be said that the Bush administration has waged war on the international order? And I'm not defending the international order, and frankly, I don't think there should be one at all, or other than, you know, just happens to arise naturally. I don't think America should be going around shaping it or anything. But, you know, I remember Richard Pearl wrote in The Guardian, "Thank God for the death of the United Nations." And it seems like the typical liberal internationalist, realist attitude toward collective security and the multinational institutions has really been thrown to the wayside by the Cheney foreign policy. So I wonder if you think this is Cheney saying, you know, I mean, Giuliani, maybe that was a little Freudian slip there. If this is Giuliani saying, I promise to be a little more James Baker-like in my internationalism to the CFR, or if this is, he doesn't really mean that. He really does plan, as you say in your article, to act just like Dick Cheney in a very kind of right nationalist sort of attitude.
Well, I think that, you know, to some degree, the question is, you know, what is the international order? You know, the reality is that even the Bush administration, I think, has recognized, you know, it's helpful if people go along and assist you. You know, their vision, of course, of the international order is everybody does what we say. So we tell them we want to go to war and you support us. You know, that's the Bush view of the international order. I mean, in the last 2 or 3 years, they seem to have come to at least some realization that, you know, guess what? Sometimes other people don't go along with you, and then you've got to compromise. I think Giuliani takes much the same view. I mean, he makes very clear in his article that we're certainly not going to be held back from doing what we think is necessary. And to some degree, I don't, you know, that doesn't bother me, as long as you have a fairly cautious and thoughtful view of looking around the world and deciding what's necessary. You know, as opposed to, I mean, Giuliani's piece suggests we want to kind of do everything. I mean, he has this bizarre analogy about, you know, the world is like a city. You make a neighborhood safe, the, you know, everything works. That's the same way internationally. Well, presumably that means he wants to create a very new kind of international order. So he'd say it's an international system or an international order. It doesn't look like anything we have today, but he claimed it was one. So part of this, I think, is just arguing definitions. He has a very dangerous vision, in my view, what international order should be.
Right. And you also point out here that his whole thing here is based on the false premise that the stateless band of pirates that attacked us on September 11th is this aggressive, malevolent force of world imperialism that we're defending ourselves against, and that they're motivated apparently by some perverted version of Islam.
Yeah, I mean, he makes it, you know, it's this whole term of, you know, Islamic fascism, and, you know, as if somehow Osama bin Laden is a Hitler wannabe. And, of course, I mean, this is the nuttiest idea imaginable. I mean, they're both evil. I mean, so they have that similarity. But beyond that, kind of the goals and their methods, and I mean, it's just, you know, complete confusion. You're not going to get good policy if you run around thinking that somehow the jihadists are like Nazis. And if only we defeat them like we defeat the Nazis, you know, everything will be fine. I mean, it's a very confused article. He kind of says, you know, this new world of terrorism, we no longer worry about nation states. But, of course, the first two things the Bush administration did was attack two nation states, Afghanistan and Iraq. And if you're thinking about the future, we're thinking nation states. It's China. It's other Russia. I mean, it's, you know, so, and he, of course, talks about them and then acts as if we can kind of tell them what to do. I mean, it's a very, you know, the whole underpinnings of this article is a world in which America kind of is able to boss everybody around. That was the world that George W. Bush thought we lived in, you know, when, you know, I mean, he inaugurated war, but I think even he today recognizes maybe that's not quite where we're at, but Giuliani seems stuck there, and that's why I think it's kind of Dick Cheney rebirthed.
Yeah, you also point out in your article that he talks about every terrorist group in the world as though they're just one force. Hezbollah is Islamic Jihad, is the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, is Hamas, is Al-Qaeda, is Jandullah, is the Iranian government, is, you know, Russia for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, it's a very curious way of looking at the world when at this very moment, one of the kind of successes of the U.S. military in Iraq is working with the Sunnis in Anbar province. Because even the Sunnis, you know, kind of normal Sunni insurgents don't like, you know, people who blow up, you know, civilians in marketplaces. So what you find is within the Sunni community, there are very real differences between insurgents and terrorists. And he just kind of lumps them all together. We've got to fight them all. Well, what that ensures is you will always have everybody your enemy. I mean, you're not able to kind of make any distinctions. You're not able to make temporary alliances. You don't get anybody on your side. You don't divide the other side. Well, that's just nutty. I mean, that's not, you know, that's the sort of thing to ensure endless war, which you really do lose, as opposed to trying to come up with something that isn't quite as disastrous as we've got today.
Right. I mean, that's really the dilemma here, is it's been years and years and years, and still our policy is based on this fantasy. And I don't know, you know, what your opinion is on this. I'm not really sure what my opinion is, whether Giuliani, well, like it says in your title, is he deceitful or is he really this stupid or what? But if our entire foreign policy is based on a misunderstanding of our enemy's motivations in the first place, or even based on a complete lack of the ability to differentiate between you know, competing groups in the Middle East and so forth, then the prescription cannot possibly be right. We are only going to make matters worse. And I guess I'd have to say my opinion leans toward it's deliberately deceitful, because otherwise, Doug, they have to say to us, look, every once in a while, 3,000 or so of you guys are going to have to die so that we can have our world empire, okay? Tough. And they can't say that. So they have to pretend that this is about anything but their foreign policy in the rest of the world.
Yeah, you'd think, I mean, they have to be smart enough. I mean, you know, as you know, Ron Paul responded to Giuliani after Giuliani gave that kind of flip demagogic response in one of the debates. Well, read the 9/11 report. I mean, it's not as if this stuff is hidden in some secret CIA document. This stuff is out there. You know, and when I talk to people, and you know, what I point out in the article is, you know, what are you telling me? Are you telling me that the American troops were bombed in 1983 for any other reason than the fact they were there? I mean, yeah, that somehow that if they hadn't been there, that what, jihadists would have shown up in New Jersey?
Referring to Lebanon.
That's right, the Lebanon disaster. Where, I mean, we got in the middle of a civil war. So, you know, what does this guy think? He thinks that you get involved in a civil war and you're not a combatant? I have, you know, he's smart enough. He's got to understand this. I assume this is simply, they have a foreign policy, and I think you're right, that they have a foreign policy they think is justified, but they also recognize American people might not believe it's justified if they knew the truth. So you have to spin these tales that they're attacking us because we're so wonderful. You know, they don't like our Bill of Rights. I mean, they've looked at the Bill of Rights and said, you know, that First Amendment is just outrageous. Let's attack America until they get rid of the Bill of Rights. I mean, it's, you know, it's stupid.
Well, if that's their strategy, it's working. I mean, that's one way, right? If they hate us for our freedom, well, we'll just ditch the Bill of Rights, and then we'll have gotten rid of all their motivation to attack us, and everything will be fine.
That's right. I mean, in some indirect way, you think the Bush administration, if they were right, should solve this, because they'll take away our freedoms, at which point presumably Osama bin Laden will go away, since we know he's only attacking us because we're free.
Yeah, exactly. And now he does say this in this article. Benito Giuliani says this in this foreign affairs article. He invokes the cowardly retreat from Lebanon and from Somalia as energizing the enemy and showing weakness and a lack of will to the enemy. And that's why we have a problem with these terrorists today.
You know, it's something which Dick Cheney has said. It's something a lot of other people have said. You know, my question to them is, well, what would you have had Reagan do in 1983 in Lebanon? I mean, we got involved to support kind of a minority, kind of nominally Christian government that basically ruled Beirut, not much more. You know, and this was, as it is today, an incredibly factionalized place where you find Muslims on different sides, you have the Druze, you have Christians on different sides. So, you know, they throw this out there and they act as if we didn't do anything. We bombarded hillsides. We blew up Muslim villages. I mean, we have the battleship New Jersey sat offshore and bombarded Lebanon. So it's not as if we didn't do anything. So what would he have us do? And you want, what, nuclear strikes? I don't know. Kill every Muslim who lived in Lebanon? Who knows? Because he doesn't spell any of that out. I mean, it's this kind of glib, you know, I'm tough, they were weak sort of thing. Now, what's interesting in that article is he doesn't name Reagan. I think this is, you know, politically, he understands that Reagan's very popular. So you're not going to criticize him by name. So what he's saying there is, you know, is that wimp Reagan, you know, who kind of got us into this.
Yep. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm glad you mentioned the battleship New Jersey in terms of, you know, the subject of what motivates the terrorists. As you said, the Marines in Beirut wouldn't have got bombed if they weren't there. And there was a hijacking, and I forget which airline or what year it was, but there was a hijacking not long after that where the hijackers were going up and down the aisles and I guess finding the Americans or whatever and shouting, New Jersey, New Jersey at them. And there was a quote from a lady who was a victim of the hijacking who was later rescued or whatever, released. And she said, you know, it was the strangest thing. He kept yelling, New Jersey, New Jersey at us. And then later on, I don't know if someone had told her or she went and looked it up and figured it out, that it was because it was the battleship New Jersey that had been shelling Beirut, as you just said, the suburbs of Beirut.
Yeah, and I mean, the point is none of this justifies terrorism, but you know, if we don't understand what motivates people, you know, when they say we're attacking them, we need to understand what American foreign policy is. You know, that if you're in a village that's being bombarded by shells from the USS New Jersey, well, you know, guess what? You don't like America very much. It has nothing to do with whether or not we're free. It has very much to do with what you're doing over there and what your behavior is. And if people, if you perceive we are attacking you, suddenly this whole thing looks very, very different. And I'm scared to have a president. We have one today, and I'm scared to have a follow-on who just doesn't get it, who seems to think the U.S. can try to run the world. And nothing, you know, nothing will happen. I mean, there's no consequence to running the world, no consequence to trying to boss everybody around, no consequence to, you know, inaugurating new wars and attacks. You know, that's a frightening world.
Doug Bandow from the Coalition for a Realistic Foreign Policy. Bill Moyers has said that the delusional is no longer marginal. And that's what really worries him. And I've heard for my whole life, basically, this certain segment of American society that says the only reason we lost Vietnam is because the gall darn Congress tied the guys' hands behind their backs. They weren't allowed to win the war. The rules of engagement weren't fair. And then right when they were about to win and they changed their insurgency strategy from search and destroy to clear and hold and build, right when everything was going great in Vietnam, the cowardly Democratic Congress caved and pulled the rug out from under them, and there were terrible consequences because we left. Now, in my understanding, that's been always, you know, 10% of the American people are actually that stupid, that that's what they really think about Vietnam. And yet, Rudolph Giuliani, in his article in Foreign Affairs magazine, and the President of the United States just 2 days ago, have been making exactly this case, that the problem with Vietnam is that the war ever ended. And now tell me, help me, Doug, believe that I'm not the one who's delusional here, because, you know, the President of the United States is a pretty high authority.
Well, you know, it's one thing to respect the office, but you don't have to respect every office holder. And in this
case,
thank
God.
If I was you, I don't think I'd spend too much time worrying about his authority.
Okay, appreciate you letting me off the hook there. Okay.
You know, it's so amazing that we left, you know, Vietnam with what was one of the, it was like the fourth largest military on earth. I mean, it was, you know, it was as well equipped as, you know, our European allies. I mean, you know, we'd given them almost everything. We'd spent 10 years building them up. And guess what? They fell apart. So now I'm told, well, the reason they fell apart was because, oh, the Democrats wouldn't let us help them even more. I mean, I think it shows the problem. If you have a regime that was not representative of its people, you know, a regime that didn't have credibility, a regime that existed only because of U.S. support, you know, that it tends to fall apart, you know, that there isn't much there. And what's amazing to me is that in his article, Giuliani argues that, well, of course, the bad things that happen after Vietnam show why we don't dare leave Iraq. And yes, you know, some bad things happen, but you know, you sit here and say 20 years later, I mean, it's extraordinary, 30 years later, 30 years after essentially the whole thing went. You know, the Soviet Union's gone, Maoism is gone from China, you know, Vietnam wants U.S. investment, the Khmer Rouge have been gone for 30 years. I mean, yeah, you sit here and say, doesn't he, hasn't he noticed that in fact we won? That despite the fact we left, you know, Vietnam in a very embarrassing fashion, we won! The other guys are gone! You know, kind of hegemonic communism, the dominoes, all this stuff, all that was discredited, disappeared, we won! So maybe that tells us about Iraq is, yeah, it could be really messy in the short term, but there's no particular reason to believe that staying is going to make it better, and we have no idea over the long term what's going to happen.
Right, and in fact, you know, I like to extrapolate that over the whole century. Everything has been nothing but intervention on top of intervention on top of intervention to solve the problems created by the last one. For going on 100 years in a row now. At some point, you know, it's, to me, it's like, that movie Trainspotting where these guys are trying to kick heroin. Like, just get over it. It's not, you're not gonna improve things by killing more people.
No, that's right. I mean, the Mideast, I mean, this, of course, people act as if, for example, our problems with Iran just kind of came out of the blue, that, I don't know, magically, the Iranians don't like us. But of course, you go back to 1953 and we helped overthrow, you know, their kind of left-wing prime minister, and we got the Shah. You know, no surprise. A lot of people didn't like this thug, and he was our guy. So when he went, the new guys didn't like us. I mean, it's, you know, and then our whole involvement in Iraq. I mean, we're worried about Iran, so we support Iraq in its war. And this stuff just, every step, it's like, oh my, that's screwed up. Now we have to put troops in Saudi Arabia. Well, it turns out that's what helps motivate Osama bin Laden. You know, I mean, these, you know, it just gets kind of again and again. It never ends.
Do you think that Rudy Giuliani, if he was the president of the United States, would initiate a war against Iran if Dick Cheney hadn't already beaten him to it?
Well, yeah, he certainly lays out that possibility in the article. You know, and he had Norman Podhoretz as one of his advisors. Now, you know, Podhoretz, you know, wants war with Iran. Podhoretz thought Reagan was a sellout and appeaser. I mean, it's kind of hysterical. I mean, this is a guy who, because Reagan decided war with the Soviet Union probably wasn't the best thing, you know, for Podhoretz, this was a disaster. You know, so I'm very concerned about the kind of people around Giuliani and his own temperament. So it would not surprise me at all that we'd find ourselves at war, if you're right, if, you know, we haven't already been there by the time the election is held.
All right, now very quickly, because we're right up against the time wall here. He wants to empower the United Nations, apparently, to intervene in Africa. And then also, as you point out, he sort of threatens Russia and China that if they don't do what we say, they're not going to be allowed to make any money anymore or something like that. If you could just touch on those two briefly.
Yeah, I mean, he clearly wants to kind of make the world better and, you know, that we should do something to make sure that we won't let, like, Darfur happen again, as if, I don't know what the UN was supposed to do about Darfur. He doesn't say. And his really nutty sentiment is, you know, we shouldn't let the Russians and the Chinese profit from the world economy. Well, he hasn't noticed, but, you know, they are already. I mean, I don't know what he figures we should do, bomb them? I mean, frankly, we're in a world which we don't control, and it sounds to me like he still thinks we do.
Right. We really are moving toward a multipolar world, and these imperialists just don't know how to handle this at all. The power's spreading out outside of their control. It's like that the children's story about the little girl who overhears the witch's magic words. She's a nice witch. Overhears the magic words that make the pot of the magic pot fill with spaghetti. And the little girl, when the old lady goes to town, the little girl says the magic words, and the pot of spaghetti starts filling up and then starts overflowing. But she doesn't know the magic words to make it stop. And there's, I just remember this one picture of this massive wrought iron lid from this massive pot floating on this giant sea of spaghetti, you know, and that's kind of, to me, that's the totalitarian communist government in China trying to dominate all this, all the new wealth that's being created from beneath them. They don't know the magic words to make it stop.
Yep.
And it's on.
No, I think that's exactly right. Though they're going to have real trouble holding that country together, and that's going to be their problem. The worst thing we could do is kind of fan their nationalist pressures by being anti-Chinese and letting the U.S. government become the new enemy for them.
Absolutely right. All right, we're all out of time. Thank you very much for yours today. Doug Bandow, everybody.
Happy to be on.